Welcome to A Guide to Art, Activism, and Culture. I'm your host, Zoe Elena Moldenhauer. This podcast is brought to you by the Aerogram Center for Arts and Culture, where we delve into social issues seen in museums and in art collections today. Today's topic, spatial concepts. Joining me is Gabriel Soto. Soto is a painter with an interest in psychedelic imagery, history, and esoteric spiritual practices. He graduated from the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts with the BFA in 2017. Primarily focused on oil painting, Gabriel currently resides in Chicago. His solo exhibition, Realms of Potentiality, will be live on the Aerogram Center's virtual viewing room through April 9th, 2021.
Well, Gabriel. No. Hi. Gabriel. When I hear your name, because my brother's name is Gabriel, but every time I hear your name, it's because of the Soto. So I go Gabriel Soto. Like, it's a very sort of oomph name.
It depends on what circles I'm in. If it's like a Latin person or something, like, and they go like Gabriel Soto.
Yeah,
call me Gabriel. But I don't like when like people call me Gabrielle in English. I'm like, no, just Gabriel, just
don't even try.
Yeah, it's like, call me Gabriel, don't strain yourself.
Well, Gabriel, thank you for joining me on our fourth episode of the podcast.
Pleasure to be here.
So we had you before on our Behind the Studios event, which was more of an informal artist talk with our newest Aerogram Center member. So can you just introduce yourself?
My name is Gabriel or Gabriel Soto. I am a painter currently stationed in the Chicago suburbs, currently in the process of moving to Maryland. And I deal with vintage imagery, political propaganda, graphic design, and just in general ideas of abstract art and figurative art coming together and the painting that I do.
And your exhibit at the Aerogram Center is currently on view until April 9th. We're excited for that as well, that we get to have you twice and be able to kind of plug you in where we can for
I really appreciate
showing
it.
You off. So I think there was a lot of good questions that were raised during your artist talk with Isabel. And I would like to continue those questions. And a lot of people were interested about, the decisions you make when working large scale. And you said yourself in the artist talk that it made you feel bravado, that you got to like be not just sort of have gesture on the paintings, but also yourself, you get to put forth a lot of expression. And so I'm kind of curious, because you also talked about how paintings have the ability to draw in space, but also what does it do to the other paintings that are also on view? So can you share more of your thoughts?
Yeah, I think I actually mentioned it as like the way a painting like quote unquote sucks in the space. I mean, and it's something that I learned to think about as I train in PAFA. They had us, copy paintings that were set already in a gallery. And it's like sort of a way of thinking about a painting, not just as an object, but like as the focal point of your attention when you're in the gallery, in the room that has the paintings. You know, a painting is a 2D image on the wall. So, unlike a sculpture or an installation, the painter has to consider how that 2D image will command the space it is in once you have it in view. So like you have to ask like from how far away will it grab your attention, or how intense that attention will be. So the painter has to consider those things and how that, how the color, how the scale, or how the, just the general graphic contrast of the painting, whether it be like a classical painting or a modernist painting, how that will affect the room it is in. For example, Robert Ryman, so like he does like mainly like white on white and different shades of white. When you put them on a white wall, they sort of meld with the room they're in, and they sort of affect it in a way that you walk in and you're sort of seeing these paintings that don't really suck in the attention that you have in the room, but rather melt into your attention of the entire space. And you're supposed to sit with them and you're supposed to stay there for a while before the actual reward of the paintings kicks in. As a contrast, you have like a Mark Rothko, which is another example. Mark Rothko is kind of the opposite. His paintings are more like black holes in the room. They don't just like meld into it. They actually feel like they create their own space that you can walk into. So as you stand in it, even though your attention goes to it as if you're going into the corridor to another room, but it's just a 2D surface. So that's sort of like what I mean, like manipulating the space. You're working with a 2D form of art, and you somehow have to make the 3D space around it be affected by it. And that's kind of like a difficult thing to do.
Right. And I think, you know, what's interesting is that so many of us as artists are working in our own homes now because we can't afford studio spaces. And part of your process, thinking about how the painting is informed by the space and the space is informed by the painting, what are some of the expectations? If the end objective is to end up on a white wall, you know, what kind of happens if you realize like, oh, this is really different and this isn't, you know, what I had in mind?
And it is a disadvantage. I haven't seen my paintings from far away ever.
Right.
And that's the kind of thing, like, I haven't seen my paintings from more than 5 feet away. And that's really, that really puts me at a disadvantage because I don't really know what my works do in a space. I really don't. I mean, I know how they look like in a virtual space, thanks to Aerogram and thanks to like having it on a screen, but how the actual object in the space behaves, I have no idea. I'm working blind.
And you're standing so close to it already just because of how large it is. A lot of people asked about what informed you to work on a specific size. But, you know, after listening to you kind of explain your influences, will you make the leap to murals? I mean, if you're talking about large scale and really absorbing, but what's sort of stopping you from taking up the entirety of your wall?
Right.
One of those massive pieces.
I mean, I have considered making murals before, you know, when I watched a documentary on Banksy when I was in Montgomery College like 8 years ago. And like, I always got really interested in like what those people that do use like paper and wheat paste to post drawings on walls. And I got really interested in that. And certainly when I was living in Philadelphia, I would pass by some streets and some walls would really be tempting. You know, I could really see like an image already happening in there. But the application process to do murals has always been like a really Byzantine process to me. Mainly, I do like the idea of a large object, though, like a canvas or a panel, you know, and that's actually why I've been attracted to more unconventional materials like plywood or stuff like that for my feature work. You know, there's something about like the large objectness of it that gives me sort of like an adrenaline rush, like this feeling that I'm making something more monumental than just a normal painting. And again, that stands at odds with my, you know, with my studio practice where I have like a small dining room to paint in.
Yeah, I'm interested. You're kind of trying to develop an artistic practice that's both classical but not classical, modern but also industrial at the same time. And so it's kind of this melding pot of these different time periods. Can you kind of talk more about what an artistic practice means to you?
I mean, in Impaffa, there was this style of painting called perceptual painting, which is basically an American observational style of painting, which was like low key, like pushed onto us. You know, it was like very much like, hey, this is how you paint. And, you know, like this is it. And, you know, I am definitely glad that I didn't keep that, you know, after graduating. I mean, it was kind of like a painful separation because when you like, you have that cognitive dissonance when you're like breaking with your training. I found Mio Rauch and, you know, other artists like him, you know, purely by accident on a textbook that was, you know, given to me to pass around in a theory class that I was taking. And I knew that I wanted to gravitate towards that instead of like an observational style. I graduated and I still had this like classical and American observational painting tradition that was very ingrained in my mind, you know, for a long time. And I was trying to, you know, draw classically, but also include figures that were sort of looking like photos from a vintage collection or something like that, kind of like going into the drawings that I made, you know, prior to the paintings that I showed in Aerogram. And, you know, there's definitely like pressure on students to paint a certain way, you know, and that's obvious. And it's kind of like both pretty messed up, you know, on behalf of the school to allow to happen, but it's also like an occupational hazard comes with the territory of learning from another artist. You know, that being said, you know, there's nothing wrong with allowing yourself to be derivative for a while. And I do consider the work that I made in Aerogram to be derivative work from Neil Rauch and other painters from the Leipzig school. You know, I specifically started this series of paintings to see what I could learn from Neil Rauch's earlier works. And I feel like by copying some of his strategies, you know, I learned about my own personal style, which is still developing, you know, and ultimately one style is going to change, you know, and that's a good thing. You want it to change. And we shouldn't want to bog ourselves down with a specific style or visual strategy or visual concepts when we're like really young, you know, like your 30s and your 40s even, you know, and I still consider myself a long ways from making the work that I feel is truly originally mine. I see it as a long and winding path that I'm just starting to walk.
You've mentioned before in your artist talk, being influenced by European and American painters, trying to figure out a narrative for yourself, incorporating it into sort of an artistic aesthetic. A lot of people are combining their own personal narratives. I mean, that's natural to happen, but including more of a Latin American narrative within your work. Is that something that you're interested in? Or are you still trying to kind of create images that allude to a narrative without sort of there being more traditional?
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly a legitimate need for artwork that carries the narrative of Latin American people, especially the Latin American diaspora in the United States as we face, you know, discrimination, and as we face, the hardships of being a minority in the United States. But I don't feel like that's the work that I'm doing. I like to sort of see myself as someone that says, like, you know, like Latin Americans can also take up Western thought and give varied and rigorous analysis of what Western history is, because Western history has dominated the world. The West has colonized the entire globe, and under the neoliberal hegemony that we have now, America sort of dominates economically, you know, and American corporations do it. And it's based on this like history that becomes anatomy of our present moment. So what I want to do is to show, you know, Latin Americans can have this abstract thinking that we can look at history and we can create diagrams of the history, and as you know, the diagrams being the anatomy of our present moment, and portray that, because we are the progeny of the West. You know, we are the sons and daughters of colonizers that, you know, that came here and mixed with the indigenous people that they subjugated, and we are hybrid. You know, we are. Like the Greek god Janus, we have two faces. We're facing forward, we're facing backward, one side and the other. To me, it's sort of like the responsibility of looking at history and looking at what has happened in the last few centuries and putting that into some diagram that I can understand and that I can use to understand what's been going on. So that's what I see. You know, I don't try to put myself or my story as an immigrant in the painting. I try to think more broadly in terms of a historical process.
And that leads me into, I think it's Aga, because you're talking about map making. I think Aga is figure in action, really touches on a lot of the issues that you're kind of raising. First, just provide a little bit more in background or context for, you know, the inspiration behind that piece.
Yeah, I wanted to create a painting that showed an explosion, kind of like the beginning of a universe, like a big bang happening. And after reading sort of like these mystic texts from the Nag Hammadi Library, which is a now long dead sect of Christianity that was killed off by the Catholic Church, I wanted to create a depiction of a demiurge. A demiurge is a godlike figure in mythology or narrative that creates the universe, but is not God. It's not the Godhead. It's not the ultimate power. It is just an organizing entity that puts things into order. I ended up being attracted to this figure of a seamstress. And I said, but she can't just be like, I mean, what you're going to do, like holding the fabric of reality, that's kind of cliche. So I wanted to see like what she was going to do. What was she like trying to make? And I said, well, maybe she's looking at a map of all possible realities that she could put down on paper. So I drew the map that's on the right side of the painting. and the shapes in it became sort of arbitrary. I didn't really want there to be any sort of like a allegory to it. I just wanted to see that she is like projecting a spatial concept in front of her. There were like a lot of struggles with that painting. There were a lot of underlayers to that painting. I did a lot of things, you know, like what could she be representing? And then I settled for a Japanese Go board, because in the game of Go, there's a lot of allegory to the game. It's a very complex game that sort of allegorizes the story of an entire universe that happens on the board. And I was like, you know what, that's kind of perfect, you know? So I'm going to draw a grid, another grid, which is what the Go board looks like. And I'm going to place some beads in there, and I'm going to have her in the act of thinking where to place the beads, where, sort of using the map as her the guideline. So to me, it's actually a cosmic image. You know, it's not just a depiction of labor, you know, although that is a sphere of analysis that's good to see like what the labor of thinking is, but it's also a cosmic image.
Continuing on your painting, Aga, who is a figure that's working, but you use your day-to-day as someone who works in the food industry. I was just, you know, curious about at least that aspect, that influence that kind of creeps into your paintings.
Yeah, I mean, the painting Fall Into the Canoma, which is the painting where the yellow fella and the little blue worker, when I was painting it, I was thinking about my relationship to being an essential worker in the middle of a pandemic. You know, we see sort of this huge building with a face and arms and legs, you know, and to me that he sort of like represents another demiurgical figure, but somehow just this one that creates the social structures that we live in today. A demiurge doesn't have to be good. The demiurge actually in Gnostic texts, in the very earliest Christian texts of the Nag Hammadi library, God was evil. I mean, God, the demiurge was an evil being that created this world called the Iron Prison. You know, so to me, he became the building, became this idea of like the grinding machine that throws essential workers at the gears. The blue worker sort of being the poor soul that fell from grace and is now in this system of like that now he has to toil, and he somehow feels resigned to his spot, you know, of being, you know, of having that host thing that he's doing. And he's like cleaning the soil or whatever, doing some menial task that to him has really no deeper meaning rather than just doing it. You know, being a line cook is definitely boring. There hasn't been one day that I'm actually engaged mentally with my work. It's funny how the rhythm goes, because there's been like a whole wave of workers that are resigning because they're either moving or they're getting another step ahead in their careers or all that. And I found it funny that actually there's this like pattern of an ebb and flow of workers, because now as all the workers that I used to work with are leaving, there's these new faces that are coming in, and I'm leaving, and then I'll be replaced. I've met my replacement already. And it's really funny how you like, you are in that industry, you are working, and then you're at the same time just part of this ebb and flow of labor in the American landscape. That's actually been a really interesting notion to me.
Hearing you talk, the two hats that you have, that you're an artist, but you're also a worker. And historically, artists were considered labor workers as well. Yeah. Now, there's a lot of issue between sort of art being valued for just their aesthetic versus the physical labor that goes on. And I'm just curious to hear your thoughts on that, since it's sort of a subject that you're already trying to uncover.
Oh yeah. Is it just me, or have you also been seeing like just everything is about like non-fungible tokens now? I think that the difficulty of making artwork is not just the physical process of it. You know, unless you are making bronze sculptures or like large textiles or something like that. I think that a lot of the work going into artwork is the intellectual labor. That's something that Da Vinci and Raphael tried to convince other people in the Renaissance, that drawing and painting, because they engage with mathematics and a visual interface, they are humanities, just like philosophy, just like mathematics, and just like writing. So I think that the artist should not just be a physical laborer, or consider that. It should also be considered a philosopher or a humanist or something like that. But as I'm saying that as an artist, I'm obviously super biased. You know, Plato said that philosophers should be kings. He was a philosopher. But I mean, going into like the commodifying of art nowadays, you know, in his book, The Conquest of Bread, you know, Pyotr Kropotkin, which was, he was a communist anarchist from, you know, the beginning of the Soviet Revolution in Russia. You know, he talks about how the arts would change if we lived in his ideal version of an anarcho-communist society. You know, and the book describes a society that meets everyone's basic needs and requires us to work a mere 15 to 20 hours a week, you know, to meet our housing, our food, and our clothing, and then our energy consumption. You know, in it, Kropotkin asserts that the arts would see a renaissance if we lived in such a system, you know, as anyone would be able to get our artistic training. We would have the time because you would work a part-time job that would meet every one of your demands or needs. You know, you would be able to go into an art school, get training, you know, for little to no cost, and then go into your private life and pursue an art practice. So there are a lot of questions, you know, that have to be asked, you know, like how would the arts change if galleries were spaces of public utility rather than private showing rooms, you know, or what would the definition of an artist change if you no longer needed to sell your work to achieve fame to maintain a rigorous art studio practice, you know, or ultimately, I think that every artist, you know, I know would like to live in a society where we are seen as agents for the public good instead of just commodity makers, you know, and I am conflicted as well because, you know, I am trying to gain a foothold in an art market. I'm trying to cement myself as an artist that, you know, should be curated and seen and collected. But what's behind that motivation is still blurry to me. You know, why do I want to be curated into shows and be seen? You know, I think that a big part of me wants to be able to feed myself and house myself and build my loved ones, you know, with the money that I make from my art so that I can, you know, dedicate myself to my artwork and with that income provide for myself. Another part, however, sees myself as like a cultural representative of the Latin American community, you know, so I want to be able to be seen not just as a commodity, but as a piece as one piece of an entire cultural and artistic tapestry. You know, do we need the capitalist system to have that kind of impact? That, you know, the second thing that I mentioned. You know, how can artists make a cultural impact across the globe without the art market serving as the structure to distribute that? There's a lot of questions that have to be answered as we go into the future, and a lot of like artwork distribution becomes digitized as well. But I do believe that access to the arts should be accessible and possible to everyone, you know, and an education in the arts starting from childhood should be seen as an essential and indispensable part of someone's education. And definitely the average worker should be able to make enough income to be able to afford buying fine art from an artist, you know, and not just like something mass produced, like a print. The average person should be able to go to a painter and collect from them, you know, but in order for that to happen, we have to look at other things that are causing social inequality, like housing, economic, racial, and gender justice, you know, free or cheap access to food, energy, internet, and higher education. You know, all these needs need to be addressed in order for us to begin to think how art will be accessible to people. That's sort of like my pre-written speech about about art and capitalism.
I think because the art market is now privatized for selling specific types of artwork, that also just sort of excludes a certain amount of people, catered to a very specific audience. So you're right. There are a lot of issues that need to be addressed before surrounding the arts, because the arts is already considered such a privileged field to both be in and pursue.
You know, how amazing would a society be if everybody's needs are met so that the arts and science and literature and all that stuff becomes now our primary motivation for getting out of bed, you know?
Yeah, I think so. Continuing this conversation a little bit, how are you kind of maintaining your arts career more on an individual level?
Like, you sent me the question that says, you know, what challenges have come up? And I think actually that's a very good question because, you know, when you're an artist recently graduated, you know, I've been gone for like a few years, you know, 4 years, but I still think that's like very recent in terms of my, you know, my professional life. there's a lot of challenges that everybody will like experience. I'm sure you've experienced your challenges, you know, that impinge you from getting to the studio and making work, you know, either the need for money and the need for income to, you know, other academic pursuits to just obstacles in the art world, you know. For me, I mean, I don't want to sound like I'm a fitness coach, but just make the work, no matter how small the progress is, you know, like, but try and make it as daily as possible. You know, if it's one brush stroke that you're doing, or if it's like you're sitting down to take one good look to your painting for 5 minutes, you know, that day, just do it and just keep that momentum, no matter if that momentum is a snail's pace, you know. Or some days, you know, after work, I'm just too tired to do anything, you know. It's extremely difficult to keep up a rigorous art studio practice, you know, and you see artists, you know, cranking out work on Instagram, like it's, you know, like day after day that they have some new painting. I mean, like, that should not be considered a truthful depiction of an art practice. You know, Instagram is a marketing platform. So of course you're going to market yourself as a super active, you know, high output artist, you know. And COVID has allowed me to have a studio in my home, but it also has cost me a lot of social isolation and lack of outside contact with like galleries, museums. I used to go to the museums every week, you know. Now I have no contact with art being shown, and that sort of, I think, has created this like weird solipsistic feeling with my art, you know, where I think the only art that exists is my art, you know.
Right, you get lost inside yourself.
Yeah, definitely. And it's not all rosy. And I'm sure that every artist that is listening to this will say the same. They have their own challenges, you know, or you work or get involved in your art scene, you know, and that can pose both connections to great opportunities, but also expose you to detrimental factors. You know, I used to work as a gallery director here in the neighborhoods of Chicago, and, you know, of the suburbs of Chicago. And I still want to keep working in the arts, you know, when I get back to Maryland. And it's very rewarding work. But here in Oak Park, I mean, I've experienced my share of racism, verbal abuse, and just overall toxic behavior from other artists, staff members, board members, teachers. And it's just been very discouraging, especially when I associate those experiences with the experience of just being an artist in general. The one factor that I think is important is that you have to have a stubborn belief that your painting practice, it's its own private realm. You know, it's, you know, this no one can take from you. It's your own space where you make the rules and you set the standards and you decide what to do, with the ultimate goal of just being the ecstasy of making art. When you own your space like this and you're separating your practice from the art market or the local art scene or the rest of the world, I think that's made painting much easier for me as it becomes more of a refuge rather than the space where I have to prove myself, you know. And it's okay to be in a rut, you know. When I have a creative block or I get in the rut, you know, I take a break. I look away for a while. I'll find something else to obsess over for a little bit, you know. But I always remember that painting is still one of my life's most intense pleasures, and it's always going to be waiting for me to get back. You know, no pressure, it's just waiting there. But those are sort of my strategies to deal with a complicated world where, you know, your experiences are not all going to be rosy, you know, which is the realistic scenario.
Yeah. Well, do you have any sort of final statements or closing reflections, anything next that you're working on that you want to share?
I just bought a new sketchbook, and I am beginning to look forward to the pieces that I'm going to make. They're going to be actually evolving. I think that my next series of works will be very different from the paintings I made for the Realms of Potentiality show. And I'm very excited to keep everybody posted on Instagram and on social media, because it's going to be very different. It's just going to be, I think, in about 2 months or so until I get my studio practice now. So right now, just the process of ideation. But yeah, I'm very excited to go into the next step.
I'm excited for you. I'm excited for the sketchbook too.
This has been A Guide to Art, Activism, and Culture, a podcast from the Eric Graham Center for Arts and Culture. I have been your host, Zoe Elena Moldenhauer. Join us on our next episode, and in the meantime, visit our website at www.eragram.org or follow us on social media at Eric Graham Arts to learn about opportunities, events, and more for artists and writers.